the gray-blue rock from the enclosing hills. Thus, Mohammed bin Laden joined hands with the first man and the progenitor of monotheism. The renovation of the Grand Mosque took 20 years. Mohammed bin Laden would not live to see it finished. Indeed, the Saudi bin Laden group would renovate both the Grand Mosque and the Prophet's Mosque a second time at a total cost of more than $18 billion. Bin Laden's original plan for the Grand Mosque is a masterwork of crowd management, with 41 main entrances, bathroom facilities for 1,440 people, and escalators that can transport 100,000 people per hour. Two wide galleries of arches enclose a gargantuan open courtyard. During Hajj, the mosque can accommodate 1 million worshippers at once. Nearly every surface, even the roof, is made of marble, lending the building a final touch of cool, impersonal, formidable splendor, the universal mark of modern Saudi religious architecture. King Saud's rule was disastrous in so many ways that in 1958, Crown Prince Faisal effectively seized control of the government. He later said that when he took over, there was less than $100 in the treasury. He couldn't meet the payroll or pay the interest on the kingdom's debt. The National Commercial Bank turned down Faisal's application for a loan, citing King Saud's miserable credit record. While the Crown Prince shopped for another institution willing to bail out the government, Mohammed bin Laden quietly fronted the money, a gesture that sealed the ties between the bin Ladens and the royal family, and particularly between Faisal and his chief builder. Mohammed bin Laden was one of the first people to view the country from above, rather than from the more modest vantage of the camel's back. He received special permission from the king to fly, an activity prohibited for private citizens, so he could survey his far-flung projects from the air. Most of his pilots were from the American military, which had begun training Saudi forces in 1953. The country is as big as the eastern half of the United States, but in the 1950s one could still fly from the Persian Gulf, or the Arabian Gulf as the Arabs call it, to the Red Sea, without seeing a single mark of civilization, except for the occasional Mercedes trucks crisscrossing the desert floor along elusive caravan tracks. The imposing dunes flatten out and the wadis become dim tracings in the bright, buttery sand. There are no rivers, no large bodies of water, few trees. Development was confined largely to the oil fields in the salt flats of the eastern province. The entire lower portion of the country, an area the size of France, is called the Empty Quarter, a great forbidding vacancy, the largest sand desert in the world. Flying over the middle of the country, one sees a featureless graveled plain. In the northern section, the few pilots operating at the time would fly low to view the ruins of the Hejaz Railroad, which the Arab forces, led by T.E. Lawrence, destroyed in the First World War. As one flies west, however, the earth suddenly lurches up, forming the Al-Sarawat Range, a steep mountain barrier that stretches 1,000 miles from Jordan to the southern coast of Yemen. There are peaks within the range over 10,000 feet high. The Al-Sarawat Escarpment divides the country into unequal halves, with the slender western portion, the cosmopolitan Hejaz, squeezed into the space between the mountains and the Red Sea, effectively cutting it off from the vastness and the radical spirituality of the interior. Like a sentry on the mountain rim stands the ancient summer resort of Taif. It is different from any other place in Arabia. The breeze from the Red Sea collides with the mountain barrier, creating a cooling updraft, which bathes the high plateau in fog and sudden violent rains. In the winter, there are occasional freezes. Before Islam, the region was noted for its vineyards, and later for its prickly pears and fruit trees, peaches, apricots, oranges, and pomegranates. Roses from Taif have such a potent aroma that they were used to make prized perfumes. Mountain lions once stalked herds of Arabian oryx in fields of wild lavender. But when the lions were hunted to near extinction, the local population of Hamadryas baboons boomed out of control, roaming the upper reaches like a horde of demanding beggars. It was to Taif, surrounded by the cool gardens and the scent of eucalyptus, that the old king, Abdulaziz, went to die in November 1953. Twice it has been Taif's unfortunate fate to stand in the way of the consolidation of Arabia, first spiritually and then politically. In 630 CE, the Prophet Muhammad laid siege to the walled city, which until then had resisted his authority. The Muslim forces gained permission from their leader to use a catapult to breach the city's defenses, despite the fact that women and children would be harmed. Later, Al-Qaeda would use this precedent to justify the killing of non-combatants on September 11th, likening the use of airplanes to that of the catapult so long ago. In that instance, the siege failed and Muhammad withdrew from the city. But within the year, the town's leaders converted to Islam and the last outpost of paganism fell. Then again, in 1924, when Abdulaziz was waging his campaign to unify Arabia, the city surrendered to the Ikhwan, only to see the town pillaged and more than 300 men slaughtered, their throats slit, their corpses thrown into the public wells. With the fall of Taif, the rest of the Hejaz lay open to the Saudi forces. In the aftermath of that massacre, Faisal, who was then one of the teenage warrior sons of Abdulaziz, led the Saudis down the precipitous caravan trail that spiraled toward Mecca. He had a vision at the time that one day a genuine road would connect the Hejaz with the nation that his family was forging, however bloodily. Until Faisal became king, however, a road to Taif remained an unattainable dream. The sheer mountain wall defied even the most muscular and sophisticated approaches of modern construction. A path could be blasted through the rock, but there was still the strategic problem of getting equipment to the site, the excavators, bulldozers, backhoes, dump trucks, and graders necessary for modern construction. Otherwise, the road would have to be built almost like a tunnel, with one segment completed before the next could be started. Faisal invited many foreign companies to bid on the project, but none of them could figure out how to do it, even with an extravagant budget. Then bin Laden offered to build the road. He even provided a timetable. Bin Laden's brilliant solution for getting the equipment to the site was to disassemble the giant machines and mount the pieces on the backs of donkeys and camels. Once in place, the bulldozers and tractors were put back together and set to work. In Taif, there is a legend that to establish the route, bin Laden pushed a donkey over the edge of the mountain and followed him as he picked his way down the course of the future highway. For 20 months, beginning in 1961, he lived with his men on the side of the mountain, personally setting the dynamite charges and marking the path for the bulldozers with chalk. Despite his timetable, work went slowly. Occasionally, King Faisal would arrive at the site to inquire about the mounting, unbudgeted expenses. The two-lane road that bin Laden built tiptoes down the granite escarpment in long, winding loops past the circling raptors through geological time zones. In the distance, the Red Sea underscores the horizon. Just beyond lies the barren shore of Sudan. The craftsmanship of the workers is evident in the stone walls and bridges that echo the caravan trail nearby. About two-thirds of the way down the mountain, the granite turns into basalt, and then to sandstone. The road widens into four lanes and becomes less headlong, and then finally the highway breaks free, six lanes now, on the yellow desert floor. The road from Taif to Mecca is only 55 miles. When it was completed, Saudi Arabia was finally united, and Mohammed bin Laden became a national hero. It is the custom in the kingdom that during the fasting month of Ramadan, beggars bring their petitions to the princes and the wealthy members of society. It's a particularly intimate and direct expression of charity. Mohammed bin Laden was known to be pious and open-handed. He paid for the operation in Spain of a man who had lost his sight. On another occasion, a man sought his help in building a well for his village. Bin Laden not only provided the well, He also donated a mosque. He avoided the publicity that usually attends such notable gifts, saying that his intention was to please God, not to gain fame. What I remember is that he always prayed on time and would inspire people around him to pray, his son Osama once recalled. I do not remember him ever doing anything outside of Islamic law. The extravagant side of Mohammed bin Laden's nature made itself evident when it came to women. Islam permits a man 4 wives at a time, and divorce is a simple matter, at least for a man, who only needs to declare, "I divorce you." Before his death, Mohammed bin Laden officially had fathered 54 children from 22 wives. The total number of wives he procured is impossible to determine, since he would often marry in the afternoon and divorce that night. An assistant followed behind to take care of any children he might have left in his wake. He also had a number of concubines who stayed in the bin Laden compound if they bore him children. "My father used to say that he had fathered 25 sons for the jihad," his 17th son, Osama, later remembered. Mohammed had already taken a Syrian wife from the port of Latakia in the early 50s. He went to the region frequently on business, and in the summer of 1956, he met a 14-year-old girl named Alia Ghanem. Her family were citrus farmers living in two small villages outside the port, called Omaranya and Babrian. The region is a center of the Alawite sect, a branch of Shia Islam that claims 1.5 million adherents in Syria, including the ruling Assad family. Within Islam, the Alawites are often denigrated as a cult, since they incorporate certain Christian, Zoroastrian, and pagan elements into their beliefs. They subscribe to the notion of reincarnation, believing that upon death a person may be transformed into another being or even a star. They also practice taqiyya, or religious dissimulation, denying, for instance, that they are members of the sect to outsiders so they can blend into the mainstream. Alia joined bin Laden's household as the 4th wife, a position that is sometimes called the slave wife, especially by the wives with more tenure. It must have been all the more difficult for a girl of 14, taken from her family and placed in the highly restricted environment that bin Laden imposed. By comparison with the other wives, Alia was modern and secular, although like all of bin Laden's wives, she was fully veiled in public, not even letting her eyes show through the several layers of black linen. Mohammed bin Laden and Alia's only child was born in Riyadh in January 1958, named Osama, the Lion, after one of the companions of the Prophet. When he was 6 months old, the entire extended family moved to the holy city of Medina, where bin Laden was beginning renovation of the Prophet's mosque. For most of Osama's young life, however, he lived in Jeddah. Though his father was by now prosperous and esteemed, the family occupied a large ramshackle house in Al-Amariya, a modest neighborhood with small shops and lines of laundry hanging off the balconies. It was Jeddah's first suburb, built just outside the boundary of the old city walls. The house is gone now, replaced by a mosque, but Mohammed bin Laden's office across the street still stands, a dingy one-story stucco building with a long row of barred windows. It bespeaks the modesty of a man who despised the show of wealth that was so characteristic of the newly rich nation. "Rest his soul, my father was very strict, and he would pay no attention to appearances," Osama said. "Our house was of a lower standard than most of the houses of the people working for us." Osama spent his early years among a horde of children in his father's house. Mohammed ran the family like a corporation, with each wife reporting on her division. The children rarely saw the great man, who was often away on business. Whenever he returned, he would call them into his office and gaze upon his vast brood. During the Islamic feasting days, he would kiss them and give each child a gold coin. Otherwise, he rarely spoke to them. "I remember reciting a poem to him, and he gave me 100 rials, which was a huge amount of money in those days," Osama remembered. The children sought to either please him or run from him. It's not surprising that the remote and powerful father stirred deep currents of longing in his shy and willowy son, even though their exchanges were rare. Muhammad frequently entertained distinguished male guests in his modest home, especially during the Hajj, when pilgrims from all over the world passed through Jeddah on their way to worship at the holy sites. In typical Saudi manner, the men would sit barefoot on the carpeted floor, resting one arm against a bolster, as Muhammad's younger sons passed wordlessly among them, serving dates and pouring weak cardamom coffee from long-spouted silver pots. The patriarch enjoyed religious debates, and he would bring together the most notable clerics in the kingdom to discuss often very obscure points of theology. By now, the bin Laden construction empire extended well beyond Saudi Arabia. One of Muhammad's major projects outside the kingdom was the renovation of the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, which meant that the three holiest spots in Islam all bore his mark. He gathered his engineers and asked them to estimate the cost of the project without profit, Osama later stated. Because of God's graciousness to him, sometimes he prayed in all three mosques in one single day. Muhammad bin Laden had a custom of marrying off ex-wives who had borne him children to employees of his company. The wives had little or no say in the matter. They sometimes found themselves marrying below what they now considered their station, to a driver, for instance, an arrangement that influenced the future standing of their children in the family. Alia was fortunate when Muhammad decided to divorce her. He awarded her to one of his executives, Muhammad al-Atas, who was a descendant of the Prophet. Osama was 4 or 5 years old. He moved with his mother a few blocks away to a modest two-story villa on Jabal al-Arab Street. The house was white stucco with a small courtyard and a black filigree iron gate in front of the garage. On top of the flat roof was a towering television antenna. Over one of the front entrances there was a brown and white striped awning, the doorway that women used. The men entered through the gate into the courtyard. Soon after Osama moved to the new house, Muhammad bin Laden died in a plane crash on his way to take another teenage bride. His body was so charred he could only be identified by his wristwatch. At the time of his death, Muhammad was still an active, vigorous man, not yet 60 years old, at the peak of his astonishing career. King Faisal said upon the death of my father that today I have lost my right arm, Osama once remarked. Muhammad's sons were not yet old enough to take control of the family enterprise, so the king appointed three trustees who ran the company for the next 10 years. One of the men, Sheikh Muhammad Salah Baharith, also oversaw the education of bin Laden's children. Their inheritance was withheld until they were 21, and in any case, most of the value was tied up in the ownership of the construction empire their father had created.
The marriage between Alia and her second husband proved to be an enduring match. Atas was kind and calm, but his relation to his stepson was somewhat compromised by the fact that Osama was the child of his employer. As for Osama, he went from being in a house full of children to one in which he was the only child. Eventually, three younger half-brothers and a half-sister would be born, and Osama oversaw them almost as a third parent. If his stepfather wanted something done, he would tell Osama, remembered Khalid Bartarfi, who lived across the street and became his childhood companion. His brothers say they didn't fear their father as much as they did Osama. Only with his mother did Osama let down his mask of authority. She was the only person he would talk to about the small things, said Bartarfi, like what he had for lunch today. Khalid Bartarfi and Osama bin Laden were from the same large tribe, the Kinda, which has as many as 100,000 members. The tribe had originated in the Najd, the heart of the kingdom, but then had migrated into the Hadramut in Yemen. The Kinda are known to be bright, said Bartarfi. Usually they are fighters, well-armed, and they have an air about them. Khalid found his new playmate calm, shy, almost girlish. He was peaceful, but when he was angry, he was frightening. Osama enjoyed television, especially Westerns. Bonanza was his favorite show, and he adored Fury, a series about a boy and his silky black stallion. On summer mornings after the dawn prayer, the boys would play soccer. Osama was an average player who could have been better if he had concentrated on the sport, but his mind was always somewhere else. After the death of Mohammed bin Laden, the trustee sent most of the sons to Lebanon for their education. Only Osama remained behind, which would always mark him as the most provincial of the bin Laden boys. This was despite the fact that he enrolled in Jeddah's best school, called Al-Thagr, on the road to Mecca. King Faisal had created the school in the early 50s for the education of his own sons. It was a free public school, but the standards were extremely high and the rector reported directly to the king. Students could gain admission only by passing a highly competitive examination. The goal was to have all classes of Saudi society represented entirely on the basis of merit. This policy was so strictly adhered to that several sons of King Khalid were booted out while he was still on the throne. Osama was a member of a class of 68 students, only two of whom were members of the royal family. 50 of his classmates went on to gain their doctorates. "He was a normal, not excellent student," said Ahmed Badib, who taught Osama science courses for 3 years. The lives of these two men, bin Laden and Badib, would intertwine in unexpected ways in the future, as bin Laden was drawn to jihad and Badib became a member of Saudi intelligence. All of the students dressed in Western clothes, a jacket and tie during the winter, pants and shirt during the rest of the school year. Osama stood out because he was tall and gangly and physically slow to mature. As his classmates began sporting mustaches and goatees, bin Laden remained clean-shaven because his beard was so light. His teachers found him shy and fearful of making mistakes. In Osama's 14th year, he experienced a religious and political awakening. Some ascribe the change to a charismatic Syrian gym teacher at the school who was a member of the Muslim Brothers. Osama stopped watching cowboy shows. Outside of school, he refused to wear Western dress. Sometimes he would sit in front of the television and weep over the news from Palestine. In his teenage years, he was the same nice kid, his mother later related. But he was more concerned, sad, and frustrated about the situation in Palestine in particular, and the Arab and Muslim world in general. He tried to explain his feelings to his friends and family, but his passion left them nonplussed. He thought Muslims are not close enough to Allah, and Muslim youth are too busy playing and having fun, his mother concluded. He began fasting twice a week on Mondays and Thursdays in emulation of the Prophet. He went to bed right after Isha, the evening prayer. In addition to the 5 prayers a day, he set his alarm for 1 in the morning and pray alone every night. Osama became quite stern with his younger half-siblings, especially about rising early to go to the mosque for the dawn prayer. He was rarely angry except when sexual matters came up. When he thought one of his half-brothers was flirting with a maid, Osama slapped him. Another time, when he was in a cafe in Beirut, one of his brother's friends produced a porno magazine. Osama made it clear that neither he nor any of his brothers would ever have anything to do with the boy again. There seems never to have been a moment in his entire life when he gave way to the sins of the flesh, venal or ribald behavior, the temptations of liquor, smoking, or gambling. Food held little interest for him. He loved adventure and poetry and little else but God. Osama's mother watched the evolution of his religious convictions with alarm. She confided her anxiety to her younger sister, Leila Ghanem. "In the beginning of his path, being his mother, she was very concerned," her sister later said. When she saw that this was his conviction, something he would not budge from, she said, "God protect him." On one occasion, Osama was riding with his family to Syria to visit his mother's relatives, which they did every summer. The driver put on a cassette tape of the Egyptian diva Kulthum. Her powerful vibrato was so expressive of love and longing that it often brought her listeners to tears or involuntary gasps of desire. The lyrics called up the ancient verses of the desert bards. You are more precious than my days, more beautiful than my dreams. Take me to your sweetness, away from the universe, far, far away. Osama flared up. He ordered the driver to turn it off. The driver refused. We are paying you, Osama reminded him. If you don't shut the music off right now, you can take us back to Jeddah. Everyone else in the car, including his mother and his stepfather, was silent in the face of Osama's anger. The driver relented. His intransigent piety was unusual in his elevated social circle, but many young Saudis found refuge in intense expressions of religiosity. Exposed to so few alternative ways of thinking, even about Islam, they were trapped in a two-dimensional spiritual world. They could only become more extreme or less so. Extremism had its consolations, as it always does. In Osama's case, it obviously shielded him from his teenage sexual urges. There was also in his nature a romance with the spirituality of the desert, humble and stripped of distraction. Throughout his life, he would hunger for austerity like a vice, the desert, the cave, and his as yet unspoken desire to die anonymously in a trench in warfare. But it was difficult to hold on to this self-conception while being chauffeured around the kingdom in the family Mercedes. At the same time, Osama made an effort not to be too much of a prig. Although he was opposed to the playing of musical instruments, he organized some of his friends into an a cappella singing group. They even recorded some of their tunes about jihad, which for them meant the internal struggle to improve themselves, not holy war. Osama would make copies and give them each a tape. When they played soccer, Osama would bring along tuna and cheese sandwiches for the other players, even on days when he was fasting. His commitment and composure commanded respect. Out of modesty, he stopped wearing regular soccer shorts and took to playing in long pants. In deference to his beliefs, the other players followed suit. They would often go to play in the poorer districts of Jeddah. During lunch, even if he was fasting, Osama would divide his teammates into different groups, named after companions of the Prophet, and quiz them on the Quran. The Abu Bakr group wins, he would exclaim. Now let's have cakes. He had an adventurous adolescence, mountain climbing in Turkey and big game hunting in Kenya. On his family farm south of Jeddah, Osama kept a stable of horses, having as many as 20 at one time, including his favorite, a mare named Albalka. He liked to ride and shoot, just like the cowboys on his favorite television shows. Osama began driving early, and he drove fast. In the mid-70s, when he was 16 or 17, he had a big white Chrysler that he accidentally ran into a culvert and destroyed. Amazingly, he was unhurt. After that, however, he made an effort to slow down. He began driving a Toyota Jeep and a Mercedes 280S, the kind of car a respectable Saudi businessman would drive, but he still had trouble keeping his foot off the gas. His science teacher, Ahmed Badib, noticed the change in his strong-willed young student. At this time, Osama was trying to prove himself within the company, said Badib. There is a law in the bin Laden family that if you prove yourself as a man, you can inherit. The Saudi bin Laden group had a contract for a large project in Jizan, near the Yemen border, and Osama badly wanted to be a part of it. I decided to drop out of school to achieve my goals and dreams, bin Laden later related. I was surprised at the major opposition to this idea, especially from my mother, who cried and begged me to change my mind. In the end, there was no way out. I couldn't resist my mother's tears. I had to go back and finish my education. In 1974, while he was still in high school, Osama married for the first time. He was 17, she was 14, Najwa Ghanem, his cousin, from his mother's village in Syria. She was unusually tall and quite beautiful. There was a small wedding party for the men in Osama's house, who never got to see the bride. Bin Laden's future sister-in-law, Carmen, described Najwa as meek and constantly pregnant. It was also during this time in high school that bin Laden joined the Muslim Brothers. The organization was very much an underground movement in Saudi Arabia in the 1970s. Only nerds were in it, a fellow member recalled. The members were highly religious teenagers like bin Laden, and although they were not actively conspiring against the government, their meetings were secret and took place in private homes. The group sometimes went together on pilgrimages to Mecca, or on outings to the beach, where they would proselytize and pray. "We were hoping to establish an Islamic state anywhere," said Jamal Khashoggi, a friend of bin Laden's who joined the Brotherhood at about the same time. "We believe that the first one would lead to another, and that would have a domino effect which could reverse the history of mankind." Bin Laden entered King Abdulaziz University in Jeddah in 1976. He studied economics, but he was more involved in campus religious affairs. "I formed a religious charity at school, and we devoted a lot of time to interpreting the Quran and jihad," he later said. In his first year in the university, bin Laden met Muhammad Jamal Khalifa, another member of the Brotherhood, who would become his closest friend. Jamal Khalifa was a year older than bin Laden, a gregarious young man with an easy smile. Khalifa came from a family of modest means, although he was able to trace his lineage back to the Prophet, which gave him a standing in Islamic society quite apart from his financial status. He and Osama played soccer together. Bin Laden, being tall and fast, was the striker always in front. The two young men soon became inseparable. On weekends, they would head out into the desert between Jeddah and Mecca, usually staying at the bin Laden's family farm, an oasis called Al-Barud. To keep the Bedouins from homesteading on his property, bin Laden erected a small cabin, little more than a kitchen and a toilet, and began farming. He kept a small herd of sheep and a stable of horses. Even in the summer, he would cast off his shoes as soon as he arrived and walk barefoot through the scorching sand. "Osama was very stubborn," Khalifa said. "We were riding horses in the desert, and we were really going very fast. I saw fine sand in front of us, and I told Osama, 'This is dangerous. Better stay away.' He said no, and he continued. His horse turned over, and he fell down. He got up laughing. Another time, we were riding in a jeep. Whenever he saw a hill, he would drive very fast and go over it, even though we didn't know what was on the other side. Really, he put us in danger many times." It was a time of spiritual questioning for both of them. "Islam is different from any other religion. It's a way of life," said Khalifa. "We were trying to understand what Islam has to say about how we eat, who we marry, how we talk. We read Sayyid Qutb. He was the one who most affected our generation." Many of the professors at the university were members of the Brotherhood who had been run out of Egypt or Syria. They had brought with them the idea of a highly politicized Islam, one that fused the state and the religion into a single, all-encompassing theocracy. Bin Laden and Khalifa were drawn to them because they seemed more open-minded than the Saudi scholars and were willing to lead them to the books that would change their lives, such as Qutb's Milestones and In the Shade of the Quran. Each week, Muhammad Qutb, the younger brother of the martyr, would lecture at the school. Although bin Laden never formally studied with Qutb, he usually attended his public lectures. Qutb was extremely popular with the students, who noted his calm demeanor, despite the fact that he had also endured the rigors of Nasser's prisons. At that moment, Muhammad Qutb was jealously defending his brother's reputation, which was under attack from moderate Islamists. They contended that Milestones had empowered a new, more violent group of radicals, especially in Egypt, who used Sayyid Qutb's writings to justify attacks on anyone they considered an infidel, including other Muslims. Foremost among Qutb's critics was Hassan Hudaybi, the supreme guide of the Muslim Brothers, who published his own prison book, Preachers, Not Judges, to counter Qutb's seductive call to chaos. In Hudaybi's far more orthodox theology, no Muslim could deny the belief of another so long as he made the simple profession of faith, "There is no God but God, and Muhammad is his messenger." The debate, which had been born in the Egyptian prisons with Qutb and Hudaybi, was quickly spreading throughout Islam,
as young Muslims took sides in this argument about who is a Muslim and who is not. Osama read Hudaybi's book in 1978 and we talked about it, Jamal Khalifa recalled. Osama agreed with him completely. His views would soon change, however, and it was this fundamental shift from Hudaybi's tolerant and accepting view of Islam to Qutb's narrow and judgmental one that would open the door to terror. That same year, Osama and Najwa's son Abdullah was born. He was the first of their 11 children, and following Arab tradition, the parents came to be called Abu, the father of Abdullah, and the mother of Abdullah. Unlike his own father, Osama was attentive and playful with his children. He loved to take his quickly expanding family to the beach. But he was also demanding. He had unyielding ideas about the need to prepare them for the tough life ahead. On the weekends, he brought both his sons and his daughters with him to the farm to live with camels and horses. They would sleep under the stars, and if it was cold, they would dig and cover themselves with sand. Bin Laden refused to let them attend school, instead bringing tutors into the house so he could supervise every detail of their education. He wanted to make them tough, not like other children, said Jamal Khalifa. He thought other kids were spoiled. Bin Laden's second son, Abdul Rahman, was born with a rare and poorly understood birth defect called hydrocephalus, commonly called water on the brain. It results from an excess of cerebrospinal fluid building up inside the neural ventricles, which in turn causes the head to enlarge and the brain to shrink. After birth, the head continues to expand unless the fluid is drained. Abdul Rahman's condition was so serious that Bin Laden himself took the baby to the United Kingdom for treatment, probably the only time that he traveled in the West. When the doctors told him that Abdul Rahman would need a shunt in his brain, Bin Laden declined to let them operate. Instead, he returned to the kingdom and treated the child himself, using honey, a folk remedy for many ailments. Unfortunately, Abdul Rahman became mildly retarded. As he grew older, he was prone to emotional outbursts. He had difficulty fitting in with the other children, especially in the robust outdoor life that Bin Laden prescribed for them. Often he would cry for attention or provoke fights if things weren't going as he wanted them to. Nonetheless, Bin Laden always insisted on including Abdul Rahman, taking special care to make sure he was never left alone. Jamal Khalifa also wanted to marry. The custom in Saudi Arabia is for the groom to pay a bride price and furnish a home before the wedding takes place. Khalifa found a suitable young woman, but he didn't have enough money to provide an apartment. Bin Laden owned a lot near the university, and he built a small home for his friend. Unfortunately, it was too Spartan for Khalifa's bride. Bin Laden did not take offense. Indeed, he made an even more generous gesture. At that time, he was living in his mother's house with his stepfather and their children. Osama and his family occupied the first floor, which he divided in half by building a wall through the middle of the living room. Then he invited Khalifa and his bride to move in. "You live on this side and I'll live on the other," Bin Laden said. Khalifa and his wife lived there until he graduated from King Abdulaziz University in 1980. While they were still in the university, Osama and Jamal made a resolution. They decided to practice polygamy. It had become socially unacceptable in Saudi Arabia. Our father's generation was using polygamy in not a very good way. They would not give equal justice to their wives, Khalifa admitted. Sometimes they would marry and divorce in the same day. The Egyptian media used to put this on television and it made a very bad impression. So we said, let's practice this and show people we can do it properly. In 1982, Bin Laden set an example by marrying a woman from the Saibar family in Jeddah, who was descended from the Prophet. She was highly educated with a Ph.D. in child psychology and taught at the Women's College of King Abdulaziz University. 7 years older than Osama, she bore him one child, a son, and became known as Hamza. Managing two families wasn't easy, But bin Laden wasn't discouraged. He developed a theory of multiple marriages. One is okay, like walking. Two is like riding a bicycle. It's fast, but a little unstable. Three is a tricycle, stable, but slow. And when we come to four, this is the ideal. Now you can pass everyone. He bought a run-down four-unit apartment building on the corner of Wadi As-Safa Street and Wadi Bashah, about a mile from his mother's home. The units were in alternating gray and peach colors, and each had window air conditioning units. There used to be an old pasta factory nearby, and because street numbers are rarely used in the kingdom, bin Laden's new dwelling got to be known as the house on Macaroni Street. He put his two families in separate units. He married again a few years later, a woman from the Sharif family in Medina, who was also highly educated. She held a doctorate in Arabic grammar and taught at the local teacher's college. They would have three daughters and a son. So this wife was known as Khalid. His fourth wife, Ali, came from the Jilaini family in Mecca, and she bore him three children. Academically undistinguished himself and clearly uninterested, bin Laden would never pursue the respectable professions such as law, engineering, or medicine that might have given him independent standing. His brothers were being educated at the finest universities in the world, but the example that meant the most to him was that of his illiterate father. He spoke of him constantly and held him up as a paragon. He longed to achieve comparable distinction, and yet he lived in a culture where individuality was discouraged, or at least reserved for royalty. Like other members of the Saudi upper class, the bin Ladens prospered on royal favors, which they were loath to put at risk. Moreover, they were outsiders, still Yemenis in the eyes of clannish Saudis. There was no political system, no civil society, no obvious route to greatness. Bin Laden was untrained for the clergy, which was the sole alternative to royal power in the kingdom. His obvious future was to remain in the family company far down the list in seniority, respected within his family ambit but never able to really make a mark. Bin Laden continued to pester his older brothers to let him work for the company, and finally they gave him a part-time job in Mina, in the holy complex of Mecca. They expected it to take 6 months, but bin Laden declared, "I want to be like my father. I will work day and night with no rest." He was still trying to finish his studies, so after classes he would race to Mecca, where his job was to level hills to make room for the new highways and hotels and pilgrimage centers that the Saudi bin Laden group was building. He insisted on working directly with the laborers he was supposed to oversee, and he spent many hours operating bulldozers and earth-moving equipment. It had already become unusual to see Saudis doing physical labor. Most such jobs were held by expatriates from the Philippines or the Indian subcontinent. So the sight of the founder's lanky scion caked with the sweat and dust of heavy construction made a startling impression. I recall with pride that I was the only family member who succeeded in combining work and doing excellently in school, bin Laden later bragged. But in truth, the schedule was unmanageable even for him. At the end of the semester, he dropped out of the university, a year short of graduation, and went to work for the company full-time. He was just over 6 feet tall, not the giant that he was later made out to be. An acquaintance recalled meeting him in this period before jihad changed everything. "Somebody died and we went to give condolences," the friend said. Bin Laden was in his early 20s. He was very handsome, with fair skin, a full beard, and broad, swollen lips. His nose was long and complex, being narrow and straight at the top, then abruptly spreading out into two broad wings with an upturned tip. He wore a black headband around his white headscarf, and under his scarf his hair was short, black, and frizzy. He was gaunt from fasting and hard work. His high, reedy voice and his demure and languid manner added to an impression of frailty. He was confident and charismatic, the friend observed. Even though religious scholars were present, bin Laden presented himself almost as an equal. When he spoke, his composure was spellbinding. Everyone in the room was drawn to him.
"What struck me is that he came from such a hierarchical family," said his friend, "but he broke the hierarchy."
Chapter 4. Change.
King Faisal sent his sons to America to be educated. The youngest, Turkey, was packed off to the Lawrenceville School in New Jersey in 1959, when he was 14 years old. It was an upper-class prep school, but for Turkey it was an experience in American egalitarianism. On the first day, another student introduced himself by slapping the prince on the butt and asking his name. When Turkey responded, the student asked, like a Thanksgiving turkey? No one really understood or cared who he was, and this novel experience allowed him to be somebody new. His classmates called him Turk, or Fieselsticks. He was dashingly handsome, with a high forehead, wavy black hair, and a deep cleft in his chin. He had his father's hawkish features, but not the ferocity that animated the old man's eyes. His aspect was more interior and bemused. Although he was president of the French club, he was a sportsman, not a scholar. He played varsity soccer and represented the New Jersey fencing team in the 1962 Junior Olympics. He was highly intelligent, but unfocused in his studies. When he graduated, he went to college a few miles away at Princeton, but flunked out after one semester. He transferred to Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., where, in 1964, one of his classmates approached him and asked, "Did you hear the news? Your father has become king." From the safe distance of America, Turkey followed the tumult in his country, including the financial rescue by Mohammed bin Laden, a timely gesture that allowed Faisal to reorganize and stabilize the kingdom during a period of rising Arab socialism when the royal family might well have been overthrown. The bond between the royal family and the bin Ladens was particularly strong with the children of King Faisal. They would never forget the favor that bin Laden had done for their father when he assumed the throne. After Israel's victory in the 1967 Six-Day War, the entire Arab world sank into a state of despondency. Turkey became so depressed that he began skipping classes, then had to make up the work in summer school. One of his classmates, a gregarious young man from Arkansas named Bill Clinton, spent 4 hours coaching him for an ethics test. It was August 19th, Clinton's 21st birthday. Turkey got a B in the class, but he dropped out of Georgetown soon afterward without finishing his undergraduate degree. He continued taking courses at Princeton and Cambridge, but was never really motivated to graduate. Finally, in 1973, he returned to the kingdom and went to ask his father what he should do next. The king understood him to be seeking a job. He raised his right eyebrow up to the sky and said, "Look, I didn't give any of your brothers a job. Go look for your own job." Of course, the king's youngest son had little to concern himself with, since his place in life was already assured by his family's immense wealth and his father's firm grip on the affairs of the kingdom. Turkey's maternal uncle, Sheikh Hamal Adham, offered him a post in the Foreign Liaison Bureau. "I had no interest in intelligence," Turkey said. "I didn't even realize the job was in the intelligence field. I thought it had something to do with diplomacy." Quiet-spoken and intellectual, he seemed more suited to a profession that relied on ceremonial dinners and cordial negotiations on the tennis court than one that called on the darker skills. He married Princess Nuf bin Fahd Al Saud from a neighboring branch of the royal family and settled into a life of wealth that only a handful on the planet could match. But the plates of history were shifting, and the blissful existence he enjoyed was drifting toward a cataclysm. Prince Turkey returned to his homeland at a fateful juncture. Many Saudis were unprepared for the abrupt transformation that their culture had endured since the first oil boom. In their own lifetimes, they remembered a country that was starkly fundamental in every aspect. Most Saudis in the 1950s lived as their ancestors had lived 2,000 years before. Few actually thought of themselves as Saudi, since the concept of nationality meant little to them, and government occupied practically no place in their lives. They were tribesmen without boundaries. The enforced equality of poverty and meager expectations had created a society as horizontal as the desert floor. Tribal codes of behavior, coupled with the injunctions of the Quran, had governed individual thought and action. Many, perhaps the majority, had never seen an automobile or a foreigner. There was little education beyond the ritual memorization of the Quran, and scarce need for more. The essential experience of living on the Arabian Peninsula was that nothing changed. The eternal and the present were one and the same. Suddenly, into this desert rushed a flood of change. Roads, cities, schools, expatriate workers, dollar bills, and an overriding new awareness of the world and one's place in it. Their country and their lives became alien to them. Thrown into the global marketplace of ideas and values, many Saudis looking for something worthy in their own traditions found it in the unsparing beliefs that informed their understanding of Islam. Wahhabism provided a dam against the overwhelming, raging river of modernity. There was a widespread feeling, not only among extremists, that this torrent of progress was eroding the essential quality of Arabia, which was its sacredness. Unimaginable wealth had fallen on these austere desert nomads, a gift from God because of their piety they genuinely believed. Paradoxically, this gift was undermining every facet of their identity. Within 20 years of the first great oil boom in the 1950s, the average Saudi income was nearly equal to that of the United States and increasing at a rate that promised to make the kingdom the largest economy in the world. Such tantalizing expectations masked the fact that class divisions were shearing apart a country that still fancied itself an extended tribal community. The spendthrift Saudi became a worldwide stereotype of greed, gluttony, corruption, hypocrisy, and even more offensive to his dignity, a figure of fun. The sheer waste of fortunes at the gaming tables, the drinking, the whoring, the avarice of the Saudi women with their silver minks and their shopping bags on the Champs-Élysées, the casual buying of jewels that could capsize national economies, amused a world that was also shaken by the prospect of a future in which the Saudis owned practically everything. This anxiety was sharpened by the 1973 oil embargo, which caused prices to skyrocket and created genuine problems for a Saudi government that simply didn't know how to spend all its money. The wholesale squandering of wealth, both public and private, only demonstrated the bottomless pocket that Saudi Arabia had become, at least for the royal family. They not only ruled the country, they essentially owned it. All unclaimed land belonged to the king. He alone decided who could acquire property. As the country expanded, the king's uncles and aunts, brothers and sisters, nieces, nephews, and cousins grabbed the richest parcels. Still not sated, the princes forced themselves into business deals as agents or consultants, raking in billions in the form of kickbacks and bribes. This toll on commerce came despite the fact that Al Saud, the royal family, had already appropriated 30% or 40% of the country's oil profits in the form of allowances for family members. Al Saud personified all the venal changes in the Saudi identity, and it was natural that their subjects would consider revolution. Nonetheless, in a society with so few institutions, the royal family was a conspicuously progressive force. In 1960, against powerful resistance from the Wahhabi establishment, Crown Prince Faisal had introduced female education. 2 years later, he formally abolished slavery. He prevailed upon President John F. Kennedy to send American forces to protect the kingdom during the border war against Yemen. He brought television to the kingdom, although one of his nephews was killed while leading a protest against the opening of the broadcast station in 1965. He was freer to act than his predecessor because his own piety was unquestioned, but he was wary of extremists who were constantly policing the thoughts and actions of mainstream Saudi society.
From the point of view of some fervent believers, the most insidious accomplishment of Faisal's reign was to co-opt the ulama, the clergy, by making them employees of the state. By promoting moderate voices over others, the government sought to temper the radicalism spawned by the tumultuous experience of modernization. Faisal was such a powerful king that he was able to force these changes on his society at a stunning pace. His sons helped the king consolidate his power. Turkey became the kingdom's spymaster, and his older brother, Prince Saud, was appointed the foreign minister. Between these two American-educated princes, Saudi Arabia began to assert itself in the world community. The kingdom's stupendous wealth would ease the disorientation of rapid change and the resentment of royal corruption. And the creation of a sophisticated, technologically savvy elite would open the shutters on this deeply suspicious, fervently religious society. But in 1975, King Faisal was murdered by his nephew, the brother of the man who protested the opening of the television station, and that promising future died with him. In the early morning of November 20, 1979, Turkey received a summons from King Khalid, his father's successor. Turkey was in Tunis with Crown Prince Fahd, attending the Arab summit. Turkey was 34 years old, and he was about to face the biggest crisis in the brief history of Saudi Arabia. That morning at dawn, the aged imam of the Grand Mosque of Mecca, Sheikh Mohammed al-Subayl, had been preparing to lead the prayers of 50,000 Muslims gathered for the final day of Hajj. As he approached the microphone, he was shoved aside and a burst of gunfire echoed in the holy sanctuary. A ragged band of insurgents standing among the worshippers suddenly pulled rifles from under their robes. They chained the gates closed, trapping the pilgrims inside, and killed several policemen. "Your attention, O Muslims!" a rough-looking man with an untrimmed beard cried. "Allahu Akbar! God is great! The Mahdi has appeared! The Mahdi! The Mahdi!" the armed men cried. It was New Year's Day of the Islamic year 1400, the bloody inauguration of a turbulent new century. In some of the disputed oral traditions of Islam, the Mahdi, the one who guides, will appear shortly before the end of time. The concept of the Mahdi is a controversial one, especially in Wahhabi Islam, since this Messiah is not mentioned in the Quran. Tradition says that the Mahdi will be a descendant of the Prophet and will carry his name, Muhammad bin Abdullah, and that he will appear during the Hajj. Eventually, Jesus will return and ask his people to adhere to Islam. Together, Jesus and the Mahdi will fight the Antichrist and restore justice and peace to the earth. The man claiming to be the Mahdi was Muhammad Abdullah al-Qahtani, but the real leader of the revolt was Juhayman al-Otaibi, a fundamentalist preacher and former corporal in the National Guard. The two men had been imprisoned together for sedition, and it was during that time, Otaibi claimed, that God had revealed to him in a dream that Qahtani was the Mahdi. Qahtani was persuaded by Otaibi's dream that he must be the chosen one. When the two men got out of prison, he married Otaibi's sister. Soon they began attracting followers with their messianic message, especially young theology students from the Islamic University in Medina, a center of Muslim Brothers' radicalism. Thanks to donations from wealthy adherents, Otaibi's disciples were well-armed and trained. Some, like Otaibi himself, were members of the Saudi National Guard, which is charged with protecting the royal family. Their goal was to seize power and institute theocratic rule in expectation of the rapidly approaching apocalypse. Jamal Khalifa, who was living in bin Laden's house at the time, used to see Otaibi and his followers preaching in different mosques, often making blunders in their recitations of the Quran. Bin Laden would have seen them as well. People were stunned to hear them speaking openly against the government. They even tore riyals in half, because the bills bore the picture of the king. These were unheard-of actions in a country that was so strictly controlled, and yet there was an ingrained reluctance on the part of the government to confront religious extremists. At some point, members of the ulama cross-examined Otaibi and Qahtani to discover any signs of heresy, but they were let go. They were seen as rustic throwbacks to the Ikhwan fanatics, the shock troops of King Abdulaziz. Indeed, Otaibi was the grandchild of one of those men. No one imagined that they